From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is off this week. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Beth Fertig. It's been almost 4 years since we first heard the name Valerie Plame, the infamous outing of the CIA operative in a syndicated column by Robert Novak back in 2003, has spawned an investigation, a grand jury, and now, at long last, a trial. But it's not exactly a whodunit. In 2005, Cheney insider I. Lewis Libby revealed himself as the source for then-New York Times reporter Judith Miller. Libby is now being tried for perjury and obstruction of justice in a case that, if the jury selection is any indication, is more about memory and media than the identity of an undercover agent. Chief political correspondent for Slate magazine, John Dickerson, has been following the proceedings so far, and he joins us now. John, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
John, Libby is accused of crimes related not to the outing itself, but the investigation of the outing. Jury selection is now underway, and you suggest that a lot of the questions from attorneys on both sides are crafted to determine whom potential jurors trust more, politicians or the media.
I think that's right. I mean, what they're trying to tell when they talk to these jurors is whether their pre-existing views about both politicians in general, but also specific members of the Bush administration, will color their ability to weigh the evidence. And then also they're testing whether they give more weight to something a member of the media might say, or discount something a member of the media might say. It's Tim Russert who will be testifying, and also Judith Miller, formerly of the New York Times. So they've been asking questions about the two of them. And as you also mentioned, memory, the question of whether people in their daily lives have been in situations where they were sure of something, or they thought they were anyway, and then it turned out, well, they were wrong. That'll be a key question, and it's something that every juror is being asked by the defense team.
And whenever they do the voir dire or jury selection process, they're always looking for an impartial jury. And from where you sit in the courtroom, how does this blind or random sample of the D.C. population appear to lean?
Well, there have been a lot of people in this jury pool who have said they can't possibly believe anything that comes from somebody who works for the Bush administration. On Thursday, there was a situation where the first five of six jurors who came out were essentially dismissed on those grounds. But then also you have the pool in this jury selection process who come, it seems, from a completely different place. Not only do they not watch Meet the Press, they don't read the newspapers, except, as one woman said, to do the Sudoku puzzles, and they have other interests in their life, which is probably very healthy. So they seem to be perfect for this case to assess it based on hearing about it for the first time.
Well, if they're perfect because they don't know about the case, then it leads one to conclude that the more media savvy you are, the more biased you're going to be. There was one would-be juror on Wednesday who refuted that notion from what you wrote. Tell us about juror number 1869.
Well, we'd had a situation before juror 1869 where previous ones that had been interviewed didn't watch the news, they didn't know any of the players in the case, they hadn't heard the name Scooter Libby, and then 1869 showed up, and he not only was familiar with journalists, well, he'd been one, and he'd been one at the Washington Post, and worked for Bob Woodward, who is a key figure in this case, and he also happened to be a neighbor of Tim Russert, and he went to grade school with Maureen Dowd.
And they let him stay in the room?
Well, he made it through the first part of the process, so we'll see if he survives into that larger pool.
Your point about juror 1869 was that being a journalist, he felt like he could be objective because he was a member of the press. He was used to hearing both sides. He could be impartial. Was that the view of the defense team?
Well, in some ways, they would like to embrace that notion. In other words, any juror wouldn't be tainted coming into the process, or if they did know anything about the case, that they would as 1869 put it, be able to weigh both sides. But in terms of the general view of the press that underlies the Libby defense team's approach, it's essentially that the press doesn't have those kinds of high standards of weighing views without prejudice, and that the members of the press who will be testifying and specifically contradicting Mr. Libby's view of events will be journalists who may, in fact, have a bias.
You yourself were named by the judge along with 23 other members of the media as playing a role in this case. Does that complicate your coverage of this?
I think it does. The press for the moment is condemned to a kind of 1970s rec room. We're not in the courtroom for the voir dire process. We're watching it all on a television screen, and that allows a little bit more comment and chatter than when the actual trial gets underway. And because the names involved are ones that most of the journalists covering the case either know or know quite intimately, it will be a challenge for everyone to kind of sort, just as the jury must sort, our pre-existing views about our colleagues and our profession. And you can argue on the one hand that we'll all stick together and protect our journalistic brethren. On the other hand, there is a desire among some of us, I think, to reassert the kind of rules of journalism and try to push away clubbiness or judge each individual journalist's role in this process the way a journalism school might, by the strictest of standards. So who knows where we'll come down individually or collectively in covering this trial on those questions.
John, we're talking to you on Thursday. Are there any new developments today we should know about that you'd like to mention?
There is a woman now who's being questioned who works for the CIA, and this has taken quite a long time to figure out whether she's possibly a juror or should be dismissed. She works in an uncovered capacity for the CIA, and in fact, this is a matter of some debate about whether Valerie Plame was undercover and was therefore actually outed, although while it's a matter of debate, it's also not at issue in this trial, since it's about perjury and obstruction of justice. So it feels like we've ground to a halt here at lunchtime on Thursday.
Well, we look forward to reading your continued coverage of this. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you.
John Dickerson joined us from a payphone outside the jury selection room. He's chief political correspondent for Slate Magazine and author of the book On Her Trail, My Mother, Nancy Dickerson, TV News First Woman Star.
If you're looking for media culprits in the Valerie Plame affair, maybe the answer isn't to blame individuals, but rather the very structures of journalism itself. As the convolutions of the Plame case reveal, the intertwined relationships on reporting beats inside the Beltway converged to obscure truth rather than reveal it. To journalism professor Edward Wasserman, this is the fault of the beat system itself. Writing in the Miami Herald, Wasserman argued that, quote, if you deliberately set out to invent an arrangement less conducive to tough adversarial reporting, it would be hard to beat beats. He joins us now. Ed, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bob. Nice to be here.
In your column, you cite a local reporter on the police beat who gets wind of police misconduct. And she knows the story is good, but she also knows that pursuing it could limit her future access on the police beat. In this case, you suggest that her ability to report is damaged by her assignment to that beat.
Right. And I also suggested that is a normal conflict that is really embedded in the nature of beats. Particularly, you described beats as being a matter of subject matter specialization, and that's one way of looking at it. It's also important to note that many, many beats are institution-specific.
Can you cite some examples of times when reporters too immersed in those institutions were unable to cover the beats properly?
Well, I think that most reporters who have covered beats will tell you that over time they create a store, repository of stories that they can't tell. I mean, what do you do when you're the White House reporter and you know that the president falls asleep during cabinet meetings? Well, you know, that's a terrific story. The American public would like to know that. And you also realize that your longevity as a White House reporter is going to be severely shortened once you've written that story. And the next thing you know, no matter how supportive your editors are, and no matter how pleased they are that you've broken that story, over the next few weeks when all of your rivals are getting the leaks and the interesting plants of stories and are beating your pants off on that beat, they're going to start to think about moving you off the beat.
So structurally, we're talking about an inevitable conflict of interest. The more immersed you get in your beat, the more likely you'll run across stories that you can't report lest you lose your beat.
That's exactly right, Bob. I mean, I got interested in this subject because I teach journalism ethics, and one of my professional interests is conflicts of interest. And it struck me as notable that we spend a lot of time anguishing over whether reporters should take a cup of coffee from a source or accept a free ride on an airplane in order to cover a story. And we don't look at the kind of systematic, routine, day in and day out benefit that reporters derive from having sources who are predisposed in their favor. Most conflicts, you say, well, if you can't avoid them, then disclose them. And here's a conflict you can neither avoid nor really disclose.
Fair enough. It is easy to see how a reporter can be compromised by being too close to his or her sources. And too much time on the beat can result in the reporter going native, like the State Department reporter who takes to wearing tweed and smoking a pipe, for example. But how do those risks trump the innumerable advantages of beat reporting? I mean, the development of sources, the ability to distinguish between a story and a non-story, and just generally the accumulation of expertise that comes with experience.
Well, sure. But look, historically, beats didn't arise in order to enable reporters to develop expertise. They arose as a way to get routine information out of powerful and important institutions and into the public sphere. And it was advantageous for the institutions toward the end of the 19th century to establish regular feeds of information to the press. It was advantageous to the sort of burgeoning commercial press to have reliable sources of information of some interest to their publics. Expertise came later, and there's no particular reason why expertise has to be all bound up in covering a particular institution. General circulation papers will have investigations units, they'll have project reporters, they'll have general assignment reporters. These are people that do not have specific beats, except in as much as they develop passions and interests and expertise in areas and go out looking for the very best stories they can find that dovetail with those interests.
And in support of your argument, two of the greatest stories in the history of American journalism, the uncovering of the My Lai massacre and then the big daddy of them all, Watergate, were broken not by beat reporters, but essentially by outsiders. So, you know, those are two for you. But arrayed against you are most everything else.
Look, when I say scrap the beat system, it's a way to – I have a 700-word column to write, and I'm trying to call attention to a problem where I think is an endemic conflict of interest that reporters have to deal with, and I think it should be out there in the open. I think that reporters should be asked routinely, what is the best story you know about that you can't write, and tell me why you're not writing it. I think reporters should be encouraged to talk about the conflict they have in dealing with their sources and the kinds of accommodations they're making, because these are critical negotiations that are underway that affect the quality of information that the public gets.
All right. Ed, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Bob. Good talking with you.
Edward Wasserman is the Knight Professor of Journalism Ethics at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia.
Coming up, we talk about the elusive quality of electability with presidential hopeful Dennis Kucinich.
This is On the Media from NPR.
If you can hear me right now, then you're listening to the podcast. And since you listen on your own schedule, you might like our newsletter because it gives a quick summary of what we're covering each week. You can sign up at onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Beth Fertig.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Are you running for president?
I am running for president.
Are you filing for exploratory committee?
I'll file an exploratory committee before the month is out.
This month?
This month.
And you're going to take on Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and all other comers?
I'm going to be Joe Biden. I'm going to try to be the best Biden I can be if I can.
Like Senator Chris Dodd, who has announced this morning that he's going to file papers to run for the presidency and forego the exploratory committee.
Tomorrow morning from this place. I'll announce that I'm a candidate for president of the United States. What I'll do is ask millions of Americans, including...
And that's why I want to tell you first that I'll be filing papers today to create a presidential exploratory committee.
Prior to his announcement Tuesday of forming an exploratory campaign committee, Senator Barack Obama was the beneficiary of hundreds of news stories speculating on if and when he would throw his hat in the ring for the presidency. Senators Hillary Clinton and John McCain have been the subjects of thousands of such stories. Yet in December, when Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich announced his candidacy, offhandedly in an interview with the New York Times, the resulting article treated the announcement as an amusing oddity and led to something less than the publicity windfall enjoyed this week by Obama. Kucinich needn't have been surprised. He endured the same treatment 4 years ago in his quixotic quest for the 2004 Democratic nomination. Jeff Cohen, founder of FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, was formerly the candidate's communications director, and he joins us now. Jeff, welcome to OTM.
Hey, great to be with you.
Let's begin with 2004. Characterize the coverage, please, of the Kucinich campaign.
Dismissive, sneering, that was the good part. The bad part is when they just ignored the candidate altogether. And it's very tough to run for president if your candidate is being ignored. And it's especially excruciating if you're a communications director and you're traveling with your candidate and he's in a room full of activists and he gets repeat standing ovations. The only candidate out of the 8 or 9 or 10 that participate that gets that kind of reaction. And then you read the newspaper the next day and your candidate is buried at the bottom.
Now, you weren't born yesterday. There's a reason for this phenomenon. What's that reason?
You and I may differ about the reason. I think that the reasons have to do with elitism on the part of the press corps, that they're too important to be mere reporters. They're too important to report what happened on the campaign trail that day. They're wise men. They're pundits. They're analysts. We know better for the American people who's a serious candidate and who isn't. So even though this guy, Dennis Kucinich, dominated the room, we're going to tell you about these other candidates that we think are more credible. Then there's the anti-democratic tendency, small d, anti-democratic. Their belief seems to be that elections are almost for their benefit and their entertainment. But I always thought that elections were for debating ideas.
And in fact, in a piece by Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone during the 2004 race, he quoted a reporter on the campaign beat as saying, yeah, if there was a battle of position papers, Kucinich would be credible, but that's not how things work. The consensus on the bus was that Kucinich was just too left-wing, too geeky-looking to be electable. Now, you know, in spite of their maybe elitist tendencies, these boys and girls on the bus have been around, and as it turned out, they were right, were they not?
Well, they were right if you believe that they weren't a part of the process. See, that's the central myth of political reporting. They have this pretense that they're not impacting the process. The reality is that if you don't cover a candidate week after week after week, and if you do cover that candidate, he will be ridiculed in all of the major media, well, then you are impacting the outcome.
So the media consensus that a candidate is marginal becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. No coverage equals no name recognition equals not very many votes.
Right. And as you say, what was in their minds? Well, they looked at Kucinich, they said, not tall enough, you know, not enough money. Well, the reality is that thanks to the internet, Kucinich raised $13 million.
But as a practical matter, $13 million, give that man one white chip. It certainly doesn't begin to amount to the kind of money you need for advertising, travel, and the other gigantic costs of a sustained presidential campaign. And the media can't cover everybody, Jeff. What should the networks and the major papers have done differently in determining how to allocate their reporting resources?
I mean, if I were an editor at a big daily, I would say, look, this is an election time. This is important in American society, in any democratic society. I want you to cover the proposals that are being put forward by these candidates. And if they have a big base in the Democratic Party, even though it may not be a base of wealth, I want you in your reporting to reflect that this candidate, when he says we should pull America out of the NAFTA trade deal, gets the biggest reaction in the room. That should be reported to our readers the next morning. And it's my attitude that if they don't want to be political reporters covering the different policies and proposals of the candidates, go into something else. You know, if they want to cover horse races, go work at the sports page.
Fair enough. Kucinich's 2004 calls for withdrawal from Iraq are now pretty much mainstream thinking, certainly in the Democratic Party. And the Democrats were swept into power largely based on popular dissatisfaction with the war. So Kucinich sits down with Mark Leibovich of the New York Times and casually announces that he's running in 2008. Then what happened?
I don't know. It was a lot of ridicule. Again, it's all expected. Kucinich can expect, unfortunately, the same sneering coverage. He's a serious candidate. And as you point out, he's actually been vindicated by events. What he said in 2004 looks awfully good in 2007. But the problem is there's no term limits for political pundits. And it's the same press corps that'll have the steering candidate, the steering coverage of Dennis Kucinich this time.
All right, Jeff. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Jeff Cohen is the founder of FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Dennis Kucinich is a Democratic presidential hopeful. He joins us now. Congressman, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
Last time around, the major media scarcely covered your candidacy, and when they did, it was as an oddity. Did you think that you were a victim of the media with a capital M, or what was going through your head?
Well, I don't believe in victimization, but I do believe that, you know, there's a tendency on the part of the media in this country to try to pick whoever's going to be the nominee early on and create a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think that it's important for people who run for public office to be ready to take a stand, whether the media wants to favor them or not.
Are you suggesting that, you know, a bunch of guys at, you know, major corporate-owned media were actively trying to squelch your campaign? You know, this guy's too dangerous. We can't let him succeed. Is that what you're charging?
I'm not saying that, you know, there's any kind of official policy. It doesn't have to be. But I'm also saying, as someone who has a bachelor's and master's degree in communications, that there is such a thing as a gatekeeper theory. And everyone understands that. The internet's changed a lot of that. But corporate-owned media, in a society where there are fewer and fewer media companies, has an ability to be able to control the debate. The Federal Communications Act of 1934 said that the electronic broadcast licensees should function in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. Now, we've gone a great distance from that goal, and I do believe that this country is capable of a much more vigorous political debate than we're seeing.
Other candidates, Hillary Clinton comes to mind, spend years and millions of dollars gauging the electorate and measuring every word and every action. That's evidently not your strategy.
Well, you know, my pollster is Ralph Waldo Emerson, who once wrote in his essay on self-reliance, "Above all, to thine own self be true. Every heart vibrates to that iron string. To believe that what's true for you could be true for everyone." I think we have to have a sense of our own humanity and how it merges with all of humanity. And my life experience has given me a great gift, and that is that I really understand what people go through, and it's given me the ability to connect with the hearts of people and to be able to not just represent their hearts but their voice. So I don't need the focus groups, the poll groups, the coterie of advisors. Well, it's always good to get advice. I think there is something about listening in the quiet moments to the universal that is available to all of us.
Well, God bless Ralph Waldo Emerson, but he never backed a winner. In your first interview with the New York Times, the interview in which you actually announced your candidacy, the paper comes out and apparently nothing had changed. You know, notwithstanding the vast movement in American popular opinion about the war, you were still treated as, you know, a joke.
Let me just say something. I think the New York Times is going through a learning curve itself. Everything I said about the war was discounted by them because they were in the New York Times and they knew better than anyone else. And it's a real burden, by the way, to be, in effect, the final arbiter on public opinion in America. It must be very hard for them because they've set themselves up as being the sine qua non and the arbiter of all that's right and holy. I mean, you have to get a Neil Obstadt or an imprimatur from the New York Times to be able to run. It's okay. I'm okay with that.
Do you reject the idea that if you actually want to win a race, that there are certain things that you have to do to create a sort of mass appeal?
Yes, I think truth has its own mass appeal. And I've come back to run again, to show people you can have someone who has the right judgment, who has clarity and foresight and a willingness to stand up and speak out when others will not, because that's not the popular thing to do. It was popular before the war in 2002. It's popular now to be against the war. The question is, do you have the courage to be able to hang in there and continue to let people know what's going on? Because sooner or later, if you're right, it's going to be borne out. And that's exactly what's happened.
Congressman, thank you very much.
Nice talking to you. Kucinich.us.
Congressman Dennis Kucinich is running for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States. He reminds us that his website is Kucinich.us.
Dennis Kucinich, of course, is not the only Democratic presidential candidate suffocating from a lack of media oxygen. There's also Tom Vilsack, Joe Biden, Chris Dodd, and Mike Gravel. But there's no question where that valuable air is going. It's being breathed down the neck of quasi-candidates Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Obama this week formed a so-called exploratory committee, and Clinton is widely expected to follow suit shortly. As anxious as the press seems to be about a race between these two high-profile hopefuls, though, we're already seeing a number of pieces questioning their chances. To wit, an article in the Wall Street Journal last week titled "Democrats' Litmus, Electability. Key Issue for 2008 Race Poses Hurdles for Clinton-Obama." Chief political correspondent Jackie Combs wrote that article and joins me now. Welcome to the show.
It's good to be here.
In your piece last week, you wrote that the issue which most concerns Democrats at this stage is electability. Can you explain what electability is?
Well, that's the sort of in the eye of the beholder concept where voters and activists and donors, because the voters really aren't tuned in as much as the full-time activists and donors are, they look at the candidates and they say, which one of these people can get elected? And I was just moved to sort of write this story or report it and then write it because it just was striking to me, my conversations with Democrats, not just in Washington, but around the country. The first thing I was hearing from a lot of these people wasn't what is their position on the war, it's can they get elected. You know, the flip side of that is the Republicans aren't making such a big issue of electability. They're more where the Democrats used to be in holding their candidates to these litmus tests, whether it's abortion rights and stem cell research, or how much you support President Bush on the war, or whether you're purist on not raising taxes, to a much greater extent than the Democrats are.
You say that the likely Republican candidates, John McCain, Rudy Giuliani, and Mitt Romney, that those three are electable, but their big challenge would be winning over the base, the more conservative part of the party. Is the idea here that you are more electable if you appeal to the moderate or swing voter than if you make your pitch to your party's base?
Pretty much. That's pretty much exactly right. It sort of goes by definition that in order to find a candidate that's acceptable to the electorate overall in November election day, it has to be someone who's more in the middle.
So why is someone like Hillary Clinton considered unelectable? Because she's too far to the left, as some people say. When you see her speak at places in New York, she's often dogged by demonstrators who believe she's too far to the right because she voted for the war in Iraq.
Right. In her case, it comes down to two main reasons. One, because she's a woman, we've never elected a woman.
Okay.
Just as for Barack Obama, he's an African-American. We've never nominated, let alone elected, an African-American. And the other for Hillary Clinton is that, you know, she just brings all the baggage of the Clinton years. She's a polarizing figure. For Senator Obama, even more than race, the fact that he's seen as green, inexperienced, is a bigger hurdle for him at age 45 after just 2 years in the Senate.
So we have these preconceptions about what electability means for a candidate. It means they have to fit a mold. But by continuously writing and talking about this question in the media, is America ready for a black? Is America ready for a woman president? Aren't journalists just perpetuating the status quo? There are recent polls that suggest Americans are ready. Newsweek, back in December, polled people and 86% said they would vote for a woman. 93% said they would vote for an African American.
Yeah, but I would argue that it isn't a media creation, and I can only speak for myself, but this is a concept that I'm reflecting from what Democrats, what the activists are saying to me. you know, many of the people you talk to, they themselves would love to see Hillary Clinton elected or love to see Barack Obama elected. And they themselves have no problem whatsoever with a woman or an African-American being president. But what they're saying is they're not so sure the rest of America is ready.
But isn't that influenced by what they read in the media, that they presume a person won't be electable because of what they read?
Right. Well, now you're getting into a chicken and egg question that I can't answer.
Is it too soon to talk about this word electability? You know, here we are in the beginning of 2007 when we haven't even begun to see what the candidates have to say on the issues and their policy positions, and some of them aren't even yet candidates.
It is too soon, no doubt about that. And so people like Chris Dodd or Barack Obama need to have the time and the opportunity to persuade people, in Senator Obama's case, that he does have the experience to be president. I mean, that's what a campaign is for, but it's also going to cost a lot of money to do that. So, you know, the danger is that if you're dismissing people as unelectable, it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if the donors who finance these campaigns, if they're deciding someone's unelectable, I guess I'm feeding your point now and arguing against myself, but it's a fact that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If the donors aren't there because they decide someone's unelectable, that person will be unelectable because they won't be able to afford the travel and the ads or whatever that they need in order to persuade people otherwise.
Or reporters like yourself don't consider somebody electable because they haven't attracted enough finances.
Right.
Jackie Combs is lead political correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be with you.
This is On the Media. I'm Beth Fertig.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last weekend, the organization Free Press hosted the National Conference for Media Reform. For those who are, quote, concerned about the state of our media and committed to working for change. Our producer Megan Ryan made the trip and brought back this postcard.
On the weekend of Martin Luther King Day in Memphis, Tennessee, where the Reverend was assassinated 39 years ago, Bill Moyers was constructing a metaphor about the state of American media today. Much to the concern of the crowd, deregulation has allowed media conglomerates to become
Goliaths, whose handful of owners controlled, commodified, and monetized everyone and everything in sight. Call it the plantation mentality.
He built his metaphor on the images of slaves and masters in pre-Civil War America.
As we saw in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, the plantation mentality that governs Washington turned the press corps into sitting ducks for the war party, for government and neoconservative propaganda and manipulation.
And when he brought the metaphor home, the thousands of people in the room, among them net neutrality activists, indie muckrakers, bloggers, low-power FM DJs, and YouTube users, all knew for sure why they'd gone to Memphis, to be part of a movement.
This is the moment freedom begins. The moment you realize someone else has been writing your story, and it's time you took the pen from his hand and started writing it yourself.
Moyers was setting the tone for a weekend that examined a broad range of media topics that had at their core the idea that media reform is a civil rights issue.
People of color have increasingly been marginalized as media monopolies grow.
Jane Fonda.
The media environment that is overwhelmingly white is also overwhelmingly male. Today, I hope to show you that a media that leaves women out is fundamentally, crucially flawed.
Jane Fonda wasn't alone among stars. Danny Glover, Reverend Jesse Jackson, and Gina Davis were there. Also on the roster, FCC commissioners Jonathan Adelstein and Michael Copps, a handful of congressmen, and an impressive coalition of scholars. But mostly, the halls were filled with citizens who cared deeply about every aspect of media, the power, the pictures, and the pipes.
My name is Scott Christensen. I'm from Columbia, Missouri. I'm just interested in issues of media consolidation.
Anthony Arnov. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. It's getting harder in some ways to get our books into commercial venues because of consolidation.
My name is Carol Winkleman, and I'm from Xavier University in Cincinnati, and I'm here to learn more about how the FCC works.
David Frankel. I'm from Winchester, Massachusetts. Very interested since the mid-60s in
the independence of the media?
My name is Meredith Sisko, and I'm from West Plains, Missouri. What brought me here was just curiosity about this movement and whether they're serious, and by golly, they are.
So serious and so focused on the injustices perpetrated by big media outlets that I found myself in one discussion defending the mainstream. Me? Producer of a show that takes pride in, you know, speaking truth to power? I felt that I had to point out that the major newspapers have broken a few important stories in the past several years. And hey, CBS does have a woman anchoring the news. But I realized that this weekend wasn't about debate or about the few exceptions to the rules. It was about diving into an echo chamber of like-minded thinkers and having a good time. One attendee summed it up.
Have you met anyone at the conference who disagrees with you?
No.
I left Memphis with a message in a bottle that there's a movement underway for anyone interested. Back to Bill Moyer's speech one more time.
And I'm going to let you in here on one of my fantasies. Keep it to yourself if you will, because fantasies are private matters, and mine involves Amy Goodman. But
Goodman is the host of a daily show on the Pacifica Radio Network. She was there too, talking and signing books. Never mind the luminaries, the celebrities, and household names. At this conference, Amy Goodman was the star. After all, Democracy Now!, the name of her show, is the dream for this civil rights movement. For On the Media, I'm Megan Ryan.
Last week in Las Vegas, high-powered executives unveiled their vision for the future, where increasingly personal entertainment meets technological innovation. I'm not talking about the crowd at the Consumer Electronics Show. The adult film industry also convened in Sin City for its annual get-together, and what happened there made media news, too. The next generation of DVDs will be produced in high definition, but there are two incompatible formats squaring off for control of the business, and big players lining up on either side. The head of a large porn studio announced in Vegas that his company would produce films on Toshiba's format, which is called HD DVD, as opposed to Sony's, which is known as Blu-ray. This caught the attention of people monitoring the tech sector because where porn goes, technology often follows. Or so that's the thinking. Joining us is Shane Bettner, who writes for UltimateAVMag.com. Shane, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So explain for us, what are the two competing high-definition DVD formats and what are their respective advantages?
The two formats are the HD DVD format that you just mentioned, which is backed primarily by Toshiba, and the competing format is the Blu-ray disc format, which was developed by Sony in conjunction with several other major CE manufacturers. Blu-ray's main advantage is in storage space. A dual-layer Blu-ray disc can hold 50 gigabytes of information, whereas currently the HD DVD format in a dual-layer disc supports only 30 gigabytes of information.
Isn't this a lot like the battle between VHS and Betamax back in the 1980s? Beta was considered the higher quality format, but VHS won out because it was cheaper and each tape could hold a lot more content. So what role did porn play back then in helping consumers make up their minds?
Porn did side with VHS, and that was a deciding factor in that format. I'm not sure that that is going to be the case now. And I personally don't believe that we are ever going to see a physical media that is as ubiquitous as the DVD became. There are far too many other ways that people can get and consume this media. To give you an indicator, Vivid Entertainment, which is a very large content provider in the adult entertainment space, at this point in time, 40% of their business is on DVD discs. And that's down from 80% 5 years before that. Most of their business seems to be shifting to cable and satellite TV, internet, and wireless applications. So I'm not convinced that one or the other of these high-def formats is going to be influenced that heavily by what the porn industry does or doesn't do.
Shane, what's the difference in the prices between the two different formats?
Currently, in terms of software, the prices are very, very similar. The bigger price has been in players. Buying an HD DVD player has been something that you could do for $500 since the spring of 06. whereas the first Blu-ray disc players that were introduced were $1,000 or more. The one thing that has changed the entire landscape of this format war, however, is the introduction of Sony's PlayStation 3 game console, which is an integrated Blu-ray disc player. And the two versions of the PlayStation 3 that are available are only $500 and $600, respectively.
When we talk about this battle between the competing forms of high-definition technology, historically it seems like Sony has been on the losing side. They did gamble on Beta. They also flunked with a successor to the compact disc and a product to compete with the now dominant MP3 music file. If they lose another technological battle, what does that mean for Sony?
Obviously, it doesn't mean anything good. They've invested an incredible amount of money in developing this format. They're losing, by some estimates, hundreds of dollars on each PlayStation 3 in order to try to get that market share. What it is offering Sony is an enormous beachhead in the format war to have millions of PlayStation 3s that are capable of playing Blu-ray discs out there. Sony has polled over 10,000 PlayStation 3 owners. 75% of the people who own a PlayStation 3 say that the PlayStation 3 is going to be the main movie-playing device in their household. Given that Sony is looking to having over 6 million Blu-ray disc players out in the world market by the end of March of 2007, that indicates a huge success for the Blu-ray disc format.
So that's the best outcome for Sony, then. If they're going to win this battle, it's going to hinge on the PlayStation 3.
PlayStation 3 is certainly a huge part of it, and this is something that swayed studios that were formerly exclusive supporters of the HD DVD format to supporting Blu-ray disc. There were over 100 million PlayStation 2s sold, and looking at that, there are several important studios, including Sony Columbia, MGM, Fox, and Buena Vista, which is Disney's home entertainment arm, and Lionsgate. All of those studios are exclusive to the Blu-ray disc format, and they're going to be releasing significant titles in 2007 that simply won't be available in the HD DVD format, including both Pirates of the Caribbean movies, and this summer, Disney is going to be releasing the first Pixar movie to high definition, which will be Cars. And essentially, they believe that people are going to go where the titles that they want to watch are. And when you think of things in those terms, do you want to be on the side that doesn't have the Pixar movies?
Well, it's quite a technology war to be watching with Hollywood studios, PlayStation, and pornography studios all taking sides in the battle over the next phase of high-definition technology. Shane Bettner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Shane Bettner is technical editor for UltimateAVMag.com.
While the year is still new, we thought we'd review the unmitigated string of bad news stories about the newspaper industry in 2006. Over the past 2 years, newspaper stocks lost 20% of their value. That's $13.5 billion up in smoke, more than the value of the Tribune Company, owner of 11 daily papers, including the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times. Downsizing is everywhere, from wholesale layoffs at the Philadelphia Inquirer to the physical trimming down of the Wall Street Journal's famously broad broadsheet. And questions remain how long there will be any newspaper in the newspaper business. We asked Dan Gretsch with the daily business show Marketplace to survey the year past and predict what's to come.
In 2006, newspapers themselves were big news. And as industry expert Dan Gilmore points out, it was all bad news.
The demolition of the classified advertising model, the sale of Knight Ridder for the low end of what anyone had expected, the imploding stock prices, the pretty dramatic drop in circulation, the fact that people in their 20s and younger, for the most part, never pick up a newspaper. They hardly know what it is.
Add to that the job cuts, the rising price of paper and ink, the gutting of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the Los Angeles Times on the auction block, and the fact that the Wall Street Journal started printing ads on page one. But probably the least covered newspaper story last year was the toll all this bad news was taking on ink-stained wretches everywhere.
People should be nervous.
Jim Vandehei is the former national political correspondent at the Washington Post.
Newspapers are losing big chunks of their readership. Their ad revenue is shrinking, and a lot of them have been slow to adapt to the new journalism world order, which is web first. And that should cause a lot of anxiety. And then you look around and you see people you know, selling the Minneapolis paper for, you know, half of what the folks bought it for 8 years ago.
The deal for the Minneapolis Star Tribune was particularly scary. That was last month when McClatchy sold its former flagship paper to a partnership of former investment bankers from New York. It was the first time a private equity firm bought a major daily paper. Private equity firms have a frightening reputation. They're known to gut companies to increase profits, then resell the companies after a few years.
I'm Jim Rutherford. I'm Executive Vice President of Verona Sewell & Stevenson.
That's a Manhattan private equity firm that specializes in buying media companies. Rutherford argues that private equity firms may be better owners than public newspaper companies.
If you're a private equity owner and you've totally gutted the business and there's nothing left, nobody's going to buy it from you.
Equity firms like his are freed from Wall Street's demand for rising quarterly profits. Instead, they work on five-year timeframes. Rutherford says that gives their papers more time to adapt to the new media landscape while preserving the quality of their journalism.
Are there instances where costs are cut? Yes. But again, you're not going to succeed in the long term if that's all that happens.
Some say newspapers are due for a comeuppance. For years, they've been monopoly businesses, bilking advertisers, creating mediocre content, and raking in huge profits. So even as their bottom line eroded, newspaper executives remained resistant to change, as were their reporters, who've seen their own monopoly on the news erode as well.
Newsroom cultures are one of the most defensive cultures there are.
Eric Newton's a vice president at the Knight Foundation, a grant-giving nonprofit that outlived its namesake corporation, the Knight Ridder newspaper chain.
You've got hospital emergency rooms, you've got the military, you've got nuclear power plants, and you've got newsrooms. Three of those are life and death operations, and one of them just thinks it is.
Newspapers themselves face a life and death situation. The scariest endgame is what's called the death spiral. Newspapers continue to lose readers, which drives away advertisers, which cuts into revenue. That forces job cuts, which erodes the quality of the paper, which chases away more readers and advertisers on and on until the paper collapses. As reporters recognize the dire situation, their defensiveness has given way to fear. Investment banker Robert Garrett is with Ad Media Partners. He says that fear is slowly turning into a willingness to try something new.
What we're talking about today is radically different than we would have talked about 12 months ago, yes. There's an oh my God here. What are we going to do? A realization that something must be done.
So what can be done? Jim Vandehei, the Washington Post reporter, has one answer. He and editor John Harris left the Post to start a political news website called The Politico. It goes live on January 23rd, the day of President Bush's State of the Union address.
I laugh because I think about like bringing people over here, and I'm like, well, is this a risky venture? What would happen if it didn't work, and like, how does that play in your conscience? And then I think, well, what if I let them stay at the LA Times? What if they stay at the Philadelphia Inquirer? What's riskier, staying there or coming here?
The truth is no one in the newspaper industry is sure how to respond to the Internet revolution. Michael Scholar is with American Public Media, my employer, at its Center for Innovation in Journalism.
There'll be an economic model. I'm not sure we're seeing it yet, but there will be one. The big question in my mind is in this churning kind of media landscape, whether or not news organizations will retain the trust with the public. As newspapers in particular try to cut staff in order to get better profit margins, and they're doing less of a good job at reporting in their communities, if the trust between them and the readers breaks, they won't have anything to bring to a new economic model when they find it.
Newspapers are entering a brave new world where the old model has to be abandoned, but a new one is still over the horizon. The Knight Foundation's Eric Newton.
50 years from now, we'll look back on this as the Wild West period and the crazy pioneering era in which nobody knew what was going to happen and everything seemed possible and opportunity flowed from every street corner. It is a wildly exciting time as long as you're not pining for what was.
The biggest names on the internet are entering the industry. Yahoo and Google are now working with papers to sell ads. But strangely enough, Newton says the company in the best position for this new era is the world's oldest news-gathering operation. It's a not-for-profit with 3,700 employees and 240 bureaus worldwide. And most importantly, it doesn't use paper. If Eric Newton were a betting man, he'd put his money on the Associated Press. For On the Media, I'm Dan Gretsch.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Alicia Rebensdorf, and Michael McLaughlin. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Brooke Gladstone is our managing editor. Bassist-composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast, as well as our newsletter, at onthemedia.org. And email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Beth Fertig.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. And thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.